You are listening to Justice Radio on WMPG with Rob Ruffner from the Maine Indigent Defense Center. And today we're speaking with Elizabeth Simone and Sean LaGrega from Maine Pretrial. We'll have Elizabeth and Sean introduce themselves and then talk about the origins of Maine Pretrial, what Maine Pretrial is, as well as why we do pretrial supervision. Elizabeth, Sean?
Good morning. I'm Elizabeth Simone. I am the executive director at Maine Pretrial Services, and I'm happy to be here today. I've been with the agency 32 years. I started as a case manager. I also interned at the agency when I was a first-year law student. Sean?
Great. Good morning, everyone. I'm Sean LaGrega. I'm the deputy director at Maine Pretrial Services. I've been with the agency for 28 years. Started as a case manager, and I'm happy to be here this morning.
So why don't you guys tell our listeners a little bit about what Maine Pretrial is and how it came about to be in the first place?
That sounds good. I'll dive in. Maine Pretrial is a private nonprofit. We have a really interesting history. In the 70s, the story goes, there were a couple of Black Panthers that had a small pot of money. They would use that money to bail each other out when they got arrested during acts of political activism. And the story continues that one time they were in jail and they couldn't get out as quickly as usual. They started to talk to other people in lockup. They found that the people in pretrial detention were not particularly dangerous people or scary people, but they were people that did not have money to get out. Back in the 70s, you would see bails as low as $50, $100 quite commonly. And they realized that there was something they could do that would also help other people. They established a community bail fund. And in the later 70s, it was formalized and known as the Cumberland County Bail Fund. That was a project that was pretty small, but they still worked with a lot of people. And they started to connect with a national organization called NAPSA, which is the National Association of Pretrial Service Agencies. NAPSA was pretty new, came out of kind of the Kennedy bail reform movement and the Manhattan Bail Project. And this kind of helped frame what happened with the Cumberland County Bail Project, because in 1983, it changed into Maine Pretrial Services and became a 501c3 and is incorporated as such. That's kind of the history. There's a little bit more as we go forward from the 80s, and Sean can dive in, but the agency was small. It's still small today. There were two counties that used pretrial after Cumberland.
When Maine Pretrial was formed, what was its, mission or purpose, and how has that evolved?
So I have the original framers paperwork, and the mission was to help indigent criminal defendants with release to the community so that they could access things that they needed, such as keeping their housing, having jobs, or accessing treatment or medical needs.
And our mission has pretty much remained the same. It's expanded a little bit over the last couple of years as we've sort of expanded our portfolio of the work that we do within the criminal legal system. But we really try and stick to our roots.
What does Maine Pretrial do if either from the individual who's in custody or from someone on the outside, what is it? How does it look? What is the on a day-to-day basis?
So on a day-to-day basis, our staff are in the local county jails that we serve, and they're charged with conducting interviews and assessments for the in-custody population that hasn't made bail by way of a bail commissioner. They take that information. We try and do verifications and then make a determination as to whether or not we can safely supervise somebody in the community. And there's a number of factors that come into play there. But we always try and go for the yes, that we will take somebody out and supervise them if, in fact, they need supervision. whether that's because of lack of financial resources or because the individual has charges that are serious enough that the court feels they warrant a heightened level of supervision.
And I'll just dive in. I'm assuming that your audience is made up of attorneys or people that care about justice. And so I would tell everyone listening, supervision is a word that rankles us to some degree. People don't need supervision simply because they don't have money. That's a construct that happens socially and in the justice system, right? It's you need bail. And a lot of people confuse the word bail with something having to do with money. The origins of that word are quite old, and it really just means release, right? But nobody thinks of it that way, right? It turns into money. And so people that don't have money tend to have then something in exchange for money, which is supervision. That has always struck us as odd. It doesn't come into play in what people see in our day-to-day, but that's what makes us tick behind the scenes and want to work at and propel Maine pretrial services forward.
Yeah, that's a really great point, Elizabeth. I think for us, the word supervision has really evolved over the years. And what it means for us is supportive services. How can we connect the individuals that we work with to any sort of services that they need, whether it be substance abuse assessments, treatment, mental health care, medical needs, connecting folks back up with things like MaineCare or food stamps, working with individuals to secure things like cell phones. And none of the services that we offer folks are mandated, but we really try and approach that service delivery from the standpoint of what do you need? As an individual, tell me what you need. We really try and meet our clients where they're at.
I just wanted to circle back to something you mentioned. I think originally, Elizabeth, you said that Maine Pretrial was in two counties. And how many counties does Maine Pretrial service today?
So technically, we're in 13 counties right now in Maine. That number has ebbed and flowed. We started in Cumbie, then it went to York, then it went to Androscoggin. We've had some expansions and contractions over the years, but right now we're doing pretrial services only in 10 of the 16 counties. The other three counties where we work are counties that host treatment recovery courts. We provide case management for all of Maine's treatment recovery courts. So there's 15 right now. There's another one coming online in Aroostook this summer that spreads that map out. But pretrial release by our agency is only in 10 counties.
You're trying to get to yes, but that's not automatic. You guys, as I understand it, go through a screening process. And generically, what does that look like, and what are the where'd that come from?
Yeah, so our screening process is basically a psychosocial assessment tool, and it really looks to follow the bail code. So we look at things like residence, length in community, family ties, employment history, and then it looks at what are some of the other needs that the individual may have? Are they on medication? Have they been in treatment before? Are they currently in treatment? And then we utilize a number of stacking tools. We have a validated pretrial risk assessment. It's been validated for use in the state of Maine twice. And that really looks at risk of failure to appear and community safety. We also utilize the domestic violence specific risk assessment, which I think a lot of listeners may know of, DOVRA, in all intimate partner violence cases. And then we look at substance use, mental health, and trauma. And then we really try and connect with individuals' family members to verify that information. So, does somebody need housing? How long have they lived in the community? Do they have a job? Do they have a job to go back to? Those are the types of things that we take into account when trying to make a decision. And of course, the nature and circumstance of the pending allegation of the individual.
Yeah, we have to really look at the factors to be considered under the main bail code. So that's part of where this comes from. I think the other part of where it comes from is that acknowledgement that human beings in lockup may be experiencing one of the worst times in their life. And so let's really look at are there needs that can be addressed. The history of this has been interesting. Risk pools were first utilized in the pretrial realm in the late 70s, right? Manhattan Bail Project, Vera Institute of Justice. If we want to nerd out, they had a wonderful project where they did some of the first research in the nation. And weirdly, the risk tools that are used today do not look incredibly different from what was initially developed, even though they have withstood rigorous analysis to validate that they work. Tools are supposed to work in the community with the population you have in your community. We know there's different pockets in Maine, right? Different communities have different strengths, if you will, different barriers that they face. Our tool has been tested across all of the jurisdictions where we work. Sean has been a real asset at the agency for many reasons, but one of the chief reasons is his ability to gather data and collect information in the aggregate. Everything's de-identified, so I don't want to scare anyone, but he has tens of thousands of cases that he has collected since he started working at the agency, and he's able to provide those to independent researchers. The situation in the field nationally is there is a schism regarding risk assessment. There's an idea that risk assessment can exacerbate racial and ethnic disparities, and that certainly can be the case. We had researchers come in and stress test ours to see if that was the case. Ours actually seemed to predict risk in a lower fashion for people of color, which was surprising to us, and women. So we feel okay about using the tool. But the thing we always tell everybody, because there's lots of jurisdictions in the country that only use tools, we actually talk to the people in lockup. And Rob, you know, you give me a call when you need to if there's somebody we haven't talked to because they don't want to talk to us because they don't feel well or they're sick or they're incapable of communicating at that time. And Rob's been a staunch advocate for making sure we continue to talk to everybody. That's a policy within our organization.
And I, as someone who frequently works with individuals at the beginning of their interaction with the criminal system and when they would be interfacing with Maine pretrial for that initial assessment, really appreciate how communicative you and your agency and everyone that works in it is with the relevant defense attorneys to have that interaction and exchange. It's been very helpful to understand the decisions are made and to so I can pass on information like they're feeling better now. Is there a chance that you can try to screen them now, for example? So I very much appreciate that. You're listening to Justice Radio with Rob Bruffner, and again, we're speaking with Elizabeth Simone and Sean LaBrega from Maine Pretrial. I think it was you, Sean, mentioned that part of your assessment is looking at Maine's bail code and, taking that into account in the assessment and in the determination of whether Maine Pretrial feels that they can appropriately supervise someone as a part of their release. And then Elizabeth, you mentioned, I think you nerded out on us a little bit and talked about you both mentioned that these are validated tools that you're using. Elizabeth, you really went into it there. But
Yes.
people in the community may say, well, these tools, it may be all well and good, but wouldn't $25,000 be a better predictor of whether someone would show up for court and or follow the conditions of bail or otherwise commit crimes while in the community? Has there been a validation of cash as a useful metric for release?
Yes, let's get right into this. Sean, you look like you want to say something.
Well, I was just going to give the short answer, and the short answer is no. Cash
Right.
does not keep people safe. Cash does not keep communities safe. So for us, we really try and individualize every decision. And with that, I'll punt that back to Elizabeth.
Yeah, and just to make this lively, cash is like playing roulette with a loaded gun, right? You have no idea if someone has access to cash or not. And interestingly, in lockup, sometimes people that don't look like they have any cash and are charged with quite serious things may be part of a larger syndicate, not to scare people, where cash can come in and be posted. We think it ought to be about risk, not money. Risk is what drives behavior. It is the best predictor of behavior. The risk that we look at is in the aggregate. We think that we can help keep communities safer by looking at risk, not financial status. The roulette that I mentioned, a judge could set $25,000 and think this is actually probably going to detain someone, or if they get out, they will show up for court. It may not detain that person. As I said, people can be part of a larger syndicate or have assets, and then that doesn't happen. I don't think that judges are making a run around the bail code. But one thing I'd like to point out is Maine has a constitution and a bail code that allows for bail, least restrictive in order to assure appearance, community safety, integrity of the judicial process. What is lacking is preventive detention. Preventive detention is a lightning rod when people in the field start talking because they hear the word preventive associated with detention and they think we want to keep everyone locked up. We don't. We want to be able to parse and sort who poses an unmanageable risk. Unmanageable meaning any condition or combination of conditions that anyone could come up with to help this person still probably is not going to work. That's an unmanageable risk that cannot be mitigated. There are jurisdictions that have preventive detention, and so high-risk people stay in and get set up on a speedy trial list. Everyone else gets out. So even though preventive detention sounds terrible and gnarly, and like it's going to lock a lot of people up. When it's done correctly, according to national standards, which exist, we can talk about that. It actually lets more people out more safely and keeps dangerous people in.
So I want to circle back to something I think you said about the judges, of course, wouldn't be doing an end round around the bail code. The example you gave, I think, was $25,000, and you gave an or. The second part of the or was that if they are released, we'll ensure they follow the conditions and show up for court. But before that was an amount that will keep them detained. That would not be an appropriate basis for setting that amount of cash under our bail code, as I understand it. They couldn't say, I'm setting bail on this case at $25,000 because I know that she cannot make it, right?
They would never say that. And in fact, there is statute that has jurists questioning people's ability to make financial release if it's set. So what I want to be clear about, I don't think jurists are trying to end run, but I do think what happens is a guessing game about who has what will happen and what keeps communities safe. That is not always informed by data and research. That's not a criticism of the bench. That's just the facts when it comes to bail, and that happens all across the country.
And to be clear to our listeners, if anyone's ever thought in my career or any episode I have criticized the bench, I was merely stating facts, not ever criticizing the bench. So I want to touch on something that you've taught me about, both of you, over the years, that some people might say, well, why don't we play it safe? If we err on the side of not releasing people because we want to be extra safe, wouldn't that make the community safer? And what both of you have taught me is that that's actually not true. There are consequences for keeping people incarcerated that in fact make the community less safe, especially for low-level offenses and low-risk individuals when they're going to be released shortly, no matter what. And can you sort of explain why that is? And so why, in fact, being pretrial and the idea of pretrial supervision is an important component of actually keeping our community safe?
So I feel like that's a two-part question, and I want to untangle it. Where I initially heard you going, Rob, was why is it not true that keeping people in keeps communities safe? And I want to take that as the first prong. And then Sean can talk about why pretrial services helps communities. This first prong is rooted in research. Gonna nerd out on you again. There's a woman named Marie Van Ostrand, who's a PhD researcher, and she has provided some of the most seminal work in the field about pretrial risk, release, and recidivism. She took I think it was 1.2 million cases from across the country, cleaned the data, eventually was able to use about 750,000 cases that looked at rate of recidivism when someone was locked up 24 hours, 48 hours, 3 days, and then a week and beyond. And what she was able to show convincingly, and it has not been refuted, even though people have cried, is that the likelihood of increased criminal conduct happens anytime 24 hours and up. Right? There is a greater probability the longer someone is detained. And the connection to reality with that crazy, cool data is so simple. People get arrested, they lose their house, they miss their car payment, their car got towed, they can't afford to get it out of impound, their kid was taken away because they were taken away in handcuffs. Lives get turned upside down when people are detained. And the longer you stay in, the worse the collateral damage is. Also, prominent researcher Ed Latessa was able to show that if you're in a community in detention with people that are high risk, if you're a great citizen, you're not gonna help everyone else in there get better. You're actually statistically more likely to become like the people you're with. So there's a couple of things happening that are really important. You lose everything and your life falls apart and you may be more likely to get picked up again or do something that you shouldn't do. And when you're in, you meet all kinds of fun and wonderful people while you're playing cards and you learn all kinds of things that you didn't know. I would add one thing. Marie Van Ostrand's research isn't so lofty that it doesn't connect with Maine. She used Maine data. Sean provided her with a few thousand cases, so that went in. We also spent a year and a half in Maine researching Maine and did a beautiful piece of work called the Community Alternative Advisory Committee Report on Pretrial Case Processing. So if anybody needs to nerd out, please look that up. That was kind of the beginning of this. Sean.
Before we switch to Sean, just briefly, both of you remember the quote unquote olden days when in Portland and many places across the state, individuals in custody would, if they couldn't make bail, 5 days a week, they would be brought over and their cases would be addressed. And the vast majority of the cases that come through the system are low level offenses. The state even wants to bail people or decides not to charge them because it's such a low level offense. That, am I correct that the data that in study that you just talked about, that when the courts, because of underfunding and not having enough judge in courtroom and clerk time, switch to Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, so some individuals by chance are in an extra 24 hours before they're released just because of the day that they were processed, according to that data, is making our communities less safe than when we could do it 5 days a week?
In and of itself, the quicker you can get out, the less likelihood of recidivism. That's the cleanest way to say it. You can make a nexus and say, because we've gone to Monday, Wednesday, Friday, people are mathematically more likely to stay in jail longer, sure. But if you want to just have the straight up data-based, not argument, but fact, then yeah, don't stay in a long time if you don't need to. There's no reason.
There's sort of a mantra in the pretrial justice field nationally that 3 days matter. So for us as an organization, we really strive to make decisions as quick as possible. And our data sort of lets us know that we average about 1.7 to 2 days from initial appearance to release. In certain jurisdictions, it's much quicker. In some of our more high functioning jurisdictions, we average about 75 to 80% same day releases of individuals.
My producer is telling me that we've hit the time mark. So I think that maybe in the future, if you guys are willing to come back, we can talk more about what all the different things that Maine Pretrial does in the act of supervising that are beneficial, not just to the individual and the community. And then maybe also sort of talk about some of the potentially, if there's time, the areas you've expanded to and the role of supporting and helping Maine benefit from the specialty courts and other things. Thank you for listening to Justice Radio. Tune in next time when we'll have another exciting guest in the area of criminal courts and criminal law and our carceral system. And a big thank you to Samuel James for his gift of music that opens and closes each episode of our series.